This is the Concealed Carry Podcast, episode number 87. And welcome to the Concealed Carry Podcast, part of the USA Firearm Training Network. And I am your host, Riley Bowman.
Riley, the man who just had to ask his grandma a million questions to figure out the Wi-Fi password that she had forgotten. And I am Jacob Paulson.
And Jacob is the guy who has a pre-flight disarming checklist. Because Jacob is the guy that has a checklist for everything.
I've lost too many knives to the TSA, so.
And it's true. I had to ask my grandma a ton of questions because I'm here on vacation in Idaho using her internet, and she couldn't remember her Wi-Fi password. So we literally had to, like, hack my grandma.
Well, it was very nice of you to visit your grandma.
And we have also with us on the podcast today a very special guest, and he is known as Top Shot Competitor, owner of Q-Series LLC, makes great quality products, and that is Gary Quisenberry. Hello, Gary.
Hey, how you doing?
Great. We're so glad to have you on with us today.
Oh, I'm happy to be here, man. It's good to be talking to you guys.
Yeah, same here. Really, the honor is all is ours indeed. So, great. So today we're going to be going over all kinds of great stuff with Gary. In fact, Gary is going to be this month. That's January's Guardian Nation live broadcast special guest as well. So here's your little preview into that. And today we're going to be going all we're going to talk about, you know, Gary's ways that he trains, practices, you know, things that he thinks are important for all of us gun owners and concealed carriers to keep in mind and to do. First, I wanted to remind everyone that today's episode is actually brought to you by Guardian Nation. And you do need to be a member of Guardian Nation to participate in the Guardian Nation live broadcast. So if you haven't checked that out already, please do so now. But really, without any further delay or getting off track here or anything, let's just get right into it. So welcome again, Gary. Why don't you take just a moment and tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, no problem. Most people know me from the television show History Channel Top Shot. I was on season 3 in the All-Star season. I got involved with all that because I've been shooting ever since I was little. You know, I grew up shooting. I'm from originally from Carroll County, Virginia, in the Blue Ridge Mountains. So, you know, the gun culture is deeply embedded there. It's something that, you know, it's just kind of an everyday part of life. And my dad took me out shooting for the first time before I was even old enough to hold a gun up myself. He would have to hold it up against my shoulder for me. So that's how I got started. Shot my whole life. Spent a few years in the Army during Operation Desert Storm, and they kind of put some fine tuning on the skills I learned at home. And then I started working for the government whenever I got out of the Army. I'm currently a DHS agent, professional firearms instructor, and you know, you guys have kind of seen me and know a little bit about me from the television show. That's about it.
Yeah. Season 3 and season 5. I watched all those seasons. Yeah. I was such a fan of the show, mostly just because I like anything that's on TV and gun related, which there's really not enough of, in my opinion.
Right. It's not something you get enough of.
Yeah. Yeah, so good old Top Shot.
I'm not only a Top Shot fan, I'm also a Gary fan from Top Shot.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it.
It's funny because I think the producers try so hard to create drama because, you know, it sells, and I get it. Like, there's nothing wrong with that. But you are, like, drama, like, immune.
Yeah. I'm a drama-free kind of guy. You know, there was a big difference actually on our end, and you probably saw that come through a lot on the finished product when it aired, was that they made an effort to focus more on the skill sets of the individual shooters as opposed to the drama and things like that between season 3 and the All-Star season. You know, the All-Star season, you went in, everybody was in green shirts. It was all based on individual skill levels. There was no voting. You know, they had the proving grounds where, you know, determined who was going to be in the final elimination stage. And to me, that was more competition and less, you know, TV drama. And I appreciate it a lot more. But not that the drama thing wasn't there. They just didn't focus on it during the All-Star season.
which is appreciated. Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Because you can't put 16 people in a house for 6 weeks and there not be drama. That's just almost.
Right.
Yeah. And guys like you, Alex Charvet, I know Phil Morton, who won the All-Star season.
Yeah. Great guy.
Was also in season three with you. I mean, that's quite a commitment, you guys. Two times you were on the show, and two times you had to take a pretty lengthy leave of absence from your normal day-to-day lives.
Yeah, if you're there for the entire time, if you make it all the way to the final episode, then you're there for 6 weeks. And it is a long 6 weeks, let me tell you.
That's intense. Separated from your family. I know, Gary, you're a family man, aren't you?
I am, yeah. I'm married, and we've got three children, all of which are pretty much grown now. My daughter's a senior in high school this year, so my youngest is a senior.
And, I just can only imagine being separated from, I got four kids myself. Now, granted, they're all a little bit younger, and they're still at home, but just that's not easy doing things like that. So you mentioned a little bit in your introduction that you got introduced to guns by your father, I think you said, when you were young?
Yeah. Yeah, my dad, my whole family, my grandfather, my father, it was, just something that was a big part of our life growing up. And you learn to respect weapons. I think a big part of it for me was growing up, there was no mystery in firearms or guns in general. You know, they were just tools that we used on a daily basis and, you treated them as such. So.
Right. Yeah. And was it more of a hunting focus or was it for fun marksmanship or
I think equal measure. We hunted, we always we grew up hunting squirrel, a rabbit, and deer, obviously, down there where I'm from. But then another thing too was we had I remember when I was a kid growing up, we had two gardens out at my grandparents' house, and we lived right across an apple orchard from each other on a big farm. And my granddad would sit out there and he would see a groundhog in the garden, and they'll chew everything up. So he's like, go in there and get the 22. And he would walk you through, sight, picture, sight, alignment, trigger, squeeze until you got the groundhog out of the garden, so one way or another. But that. And then I'm the oldest of four. So I've got three brothers. And, even when we were growing up, it was always a competition and some sort of marksmanship, whether it be with a bow, a rifle, a rock, a slingshot, whatever we could get our hands on. And that stands to this day. Like, I'll go home to visit. I was just down there for Thanksgiving. And inevitably, somebody's like, hey, check out this new bow. And then the next thing you know, it turns into a competition out in the front yard. So,
funny.
So equal measure. A lot of it was necessity, but a lot of it was just, good old-fashioned fun.
Nice. Do you feel like that in some way prepared you for your experiences on shows like Top Shot? Or even in your military or law enforcement experience?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one, it makes you comfortable around them and you learn to respect them. Another thing, too, about growing up hunting, not only do you have a respect for the firearm, but you also have a respect for life itself. And I think that's one thing that's missing in today's culture with a lot of kids. They grow up more around video games and there's no connection to the life element of it and how precious that is and what you need to do to protect it. So, we learned a lot of very valuable lessons, and that always carried through to, my future careers in the military and in law enforcement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, good stuff. Yeah. So we touched a little bit on Top Shot, and I just want to pick your brain here a little bit.
Yeah.
What was the competition really like? I mean, for instance, we see what was projected on the TV screen.
Right.
Have you watched the episodes that you appeared in?
Yeah, we have. Like, one of the things that they always, encouraged was for us to have viewing parties. So, like, for me personally, I was living in Ohio at the time, and we would get together at Buffalo Wild Wings in the back, and people, it would be advertised that, we were going to have a Top Shot viewing party, and I was going to be there, and just tons of people would show up, and they'd play it on the big screens, and it was a really, really good time. But, and the one thing that always amazed me is how many people would bring their children out. Like, that was truly, I think, a family show. And children, especially, love that show, which is while I was there, I was always a big proponent of showing more, let's not focus so much on the drama and focus on, sportsmanship and fun and, that kind of thing. If kids are going to be watching this, let's try to teach a lesson. So,
yeah. Yeah, it's funny you mentioned that because, so, you know, before we started the episode here today, I was mentioning how I'm friends with Alex Charvette in season three and also in the All-Star season as well. And for that All-Star season, because I became friends with him between those seasons. And so for All-Stars, he did the exact same thing, had a big old viewing party, invited a bunch of friends and family over. And yeah, there was kids and it was a good time. So yeah, fun stuff. What did you feel like, what was actually projected on the screen, that it represented what the actual competition was like, or was it different than how you viewed it?
No, you know, it was, I think it was very true to form. Like, there was nothing that was like injected into it just to make it more dramatic or to make us act a certain way. Like there's a couple of people I think that were on the fence who were all about the competition or a little bit about the drama, and those people could come off one way or another, and it wasn't a true representation, I think, of who they were as a person. But the competition itself, like what you saw was what you got. That's exactly what happened. Now, that being said, every episode is 3 days long. It takes 3 days to film an episode. So on day one, you'll have practice. And then on day two, you'll have the actual competition. And the, on season three, it was where you went and you voted for who you wanted to send to the elimination. And in the All-Star season, it was the proving ground that you went to see who went to elimination. But then on the third day, it was the practice and the actual elimination itself. So those 3 days, made up an episode. So there was so much going on and so much interaction and so much hurry up and wait and then, rush, 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 and then a whole lot of downtime, that when you watch an episode, it looks way more exciting than it actually was in reality. Like, it was, it seems like a lot of it just took forever. But the personalities, the competition, the excitement that you see in the shooters and, things like that, that was all, that's how it went down. Mm.
Now, in both season, All-Star and season three, you finished third.
Yeah. Twice. Third place.
Yeah. Were you disappointed by that at all? Or did you feel pretty happy and, satisfied with how you performed?
Well, I think anybody that goes there that has any kind of competitive spirit, they go there to win. So, there is a little bit of disappointment, but, it's really hard to look back on that and say that you were disappointed in how you did, as long as, you gave it your best shot. You didn't come out looking like a complete jerk, for lack of a better word. And, you made a lot of good friends doing that too. Like, I'm really, I'm good friends with Alex, Phil, several people. And when I went into season three, I actually went into that competition with one of my best friends in the world, Jarrett Grimes. And you stay close to those folks. It's just, it goes a lot deeper than the win or the loss, although the win would have been really, really nice.
Yeah. Yeah. tell us a little bit more about the challenges themselves. I guess there's a lot of questions about the challenges, Gary, but I'm wondering, one, about expectations. I don't know what you were told. I mean, obviously you were starting up in season three, so you already had some sense from season one, season two, what to expect. But talk a little bit about, your expectation relative to the challenges and what really, you were confronted with.
Well, I had a little bit of a leg up going into the competition because from season one, I was really good friends with and worked with J.J. Ricazza. And, you'll recall J.J. finished third on season one. Well, as soon as that was over, J.J., got in touch with me and he goes, hey, you and Jarrett should put in for this because you'd be really good at it. You love it. It's a whole lot of fun. Season two rolled around and I was in the process of moving from Atlantic City, New Jersey to Ohio. And I didn't want to, deal with all that during a move. By the time season three rolled around, we decided we were going to put in for it and just see how it worked out. So, with the challenges and everything, as far as expectation goes, I had a little bit of a heads up on how things were going to go. But really and truly, you're not prepared for what is going to be in front of you. For one, on season three, when they take you out to the challenges, you're going out there in a vehicle. It's completely blacked out, so you can't see what is going on around you. And, you know, you'll practice beforehand, because you knew about, I think I knew about 3 months before I went to Top Shot that I was actually going to go there. So I started doing all kinds of weird stuff, you know, and practicing with things that I wasn't necessarily comfortable with. And I know what I had seen on season one. I know what I had seen on season two. And based on those two seasons, I thought I had a pretty good grip on what was going to happen to me in season three. And then when I got there, I just couldn't be more shocked by some of the things they had us doing.
So, give us an example, Gary. Like, give us one or two that you're like, what the crap is this?
Yeah, I'll give you the perfect example. And I had to do this on both of the seasons that I was in. And I called it the Ferris Wheel of Death. I forget exactly what the name of the challenge was. But they strap you in. Yeah, they strap you into this carnival ride, basically. I mean, it's like a one-arm Ferris wheel. And they handed you, I think we were shooting H&Ks. I forget exactly what we were shooting. But you've got like 30-some exploding targets in front of you in a giant circle that goes 30 feet in the air. And then they inform you that once you're strapped in, you're going to get one loop that gets you up to speed, which is like 15 miles an hour. And yeah, exactly. And then you're going to hear a horn go off, and then you're going to start shooting at these targets that you're spinning around 30 feet in the air, 15 miles an hour. You're going to shoot as many of these targets as you can. And then you'll hear another horn. You stop shooting and you go one more lap to kind of decrease your speed and get you back down to the bottom where they can take you out of this contraption. And the whole time I'm thinking, I'm like, you know, there's nothing I've done in my life that could possibly prepare me for this. So what the hell is my strategy going to be going? There's no sight alignment, sight picture, because one, you're strapped into this harness that keeps you from punching out all the way to get a good sight picture. So you're basically just kind of locking yourself out so that you're as stable as you possibly can be. And when that thing starts spinning and you hear that horn, you just start pulling the trigger. And if by chance one of the targets explode, then you just try to keep that rhythm. You know what I mean? And if you fall off that rhythm, the next thing, you've got one lap. It's over before you know it. So before you really get your bearings, it's over. So it's really just kind of a spray and pray thing. And, you know, we were introduced to a lot of folks that were on the art department, and they did a lot of the set design and stuff like that. So this challenge was designed by somebody who had obviously, you know, didn't consider what it would take to actually hit all those targets. And, you know, they were more about, well, this is going to look fantastic on television. And when I watched it, you know, it looked great. It looked like it was a whole lot of fun. But the reality of it was damn near impossible. And I don't care what anybody tells you, if they hit more than six, that was just blind luck. There was no skill involved with that whatsoever. So I don't care. You can talk to anybody else that went through those challenges, and I'm telling you the truth. There was a lot of luck there. It was like 90% luck, 10% skill, maybe. That's one of the challenges that really sticks out in my head. It was just a level of ridiculousness that I'll never get over.
How about some of the guns? Talk about, you know, were there some guns that you were just like pumped to shoot, or like, are you kidding me? I have to shoot this? Or, you know, what about the guns themselves?
Well, you know, it wasn't just guns. You know, there was a lot of things I was pumped for. One, and everybody asked me what was my favorite gun to shoot, you know, the whole time. And I would have to say during the elimination rounds and, you know, the voting, we shot a old single action army, a Colt single action army. And I love that. You know, that's like my favorite gun. And, you know, I grew up as a kid, like most of the boys, I had the cap gun, you know, and the little pleather holster and all that. So, you know, that was the big boy version of the gun that I grew up with, making me think that I was a cowboy. So it was a lot of fun to get out there and actually shoot that gun. There were some things that I got an opportunity to shoot that I wouldn't have got to shoot otherwise. McMillan TAC 50 for one, which was a horrible challenge for me. I sucked at that. But, you know, just the long range sniper rifles. There's a lot of things they had on the show that I wanted to shoot, but I didn't get a chance to because it was used in an elimination round or something. And I was happy to not be in the elimination round. But at the same time, I'm sitting over there like, man, I really wish I would have had a chance to shoot that, like the Gatling gun or the cannons and things like that. So,
yeah,
but, you know, I'd have to say, as far as my favorite overall gun, it was always that, just that old Colt single action army.
I love that. Cause that's, one of the, probably not the oldest gun or style of gun you shot, but definitely one of them.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. That's fun. That's good stuff.
You know, and the funny thing about it was it wasn't very accurate, you know. So it ain't like you was going to go up there and really showcase your skill as a marksman. But, you know, you got to go up there and pull the trigger on an old cowboy gun. So how bad could it be?
You know, before we kind of shift gears and maybe talk about some other stuff here, behind the scenes, was there either out of season three or the All-Star season, anything memorable that happened that maybe we didn't see on screen?
Oh gosh, there's so much that used to happen, you know, that was, you know, hilarious. There was a, you know, there was a lot of drama, you know, which goes without saying, but that was overshadowed by the amount of just sheer fun that we had with each other in the house. I know you guys are very familiar with Mike Hughes, you know. Yeah, me and Mike were actually in season three. We bunked together in a room. There's, you know, five or six of us. And, you know, Mike, every day, it's a funny story. I'm going to tell it on Mike, and he's probably going to hear it, but it's okay. But and you guys may even know this about Mike. But he would not leave the house in the morning without his cargo pockets jammed full of yams. Like, he, you know, he's a big fitness guy. And, you know, he always wanted a pocket full, and he would have sandwich bags full of yams just shoved in his pockets. It's the funniest thing I've done. So, you know, at some point during the day, you know, they'd be filming and they're like, what's Mike doing? Well, he's eating a yam. So we got to wait until, you know, until he finishes his yam. But, some of the most memorable stuff was, and this happened in season three, and it's something you would never in a million years see on camera. You know, Jake Zwig, the Navy SEAL who was, on season three with us and ended up quitting, you know, close to the competition. You know, that guy gets a really bad rap, and I don't agree with the way he went out on that show at all. But as a person, I never had a problem with Jake. You know, he was a lot of fun. He was a really interesting guy. One of the smartest dudes I've ever met in my life, you know, just sharp as a tack. But Jake invented a game while we were in the house called, because we had little games laying around in the backyard. We had a couple softball gloves and a softball, and there was a little mini golf course. But we had bocce balls, and nobody knew how to play bocce ball, right? So Jake invented extreme bocce ball. And whenever we weren't filming, we'd be at the house and we'd be bored out of our minds. So we start playing extreme bocce ball. And you'd take the, you know, the little white ball or whatever the marker ball was or whatever it's called. And he would just turn around and chuck it as far as he could chuck it. And you didn't know where it was going to go. It could go through a window in the house for all he knew. But then everybody else had to try to get their ball as close as they could, you know, to that. And, man, there was lighting and stuff outside, and lights were getting broke. And, you know, we were just knocking shingles off the house, and it got pretty ridiculous. So the production crew was like, hey, guys, you know, when this is all over, we're going to have to sell this house. So we'd appreciate it if you wouldn't tear it up any more than you have to. So we had to stop playing extreme bocce ball. But, man, it was a lot of fun. It should be an Olympic sport. It was fantastic.
That's great.
Good stuff. So beginning kind of the transition from Top Shot into some of the other topics we wanted to cover with you today, what did you do, if anything, to prepare for Top Shot? I mean, you kind of mentioned a little bit ago about how you were trying to do some different things, maybe some crazy things ahead of time. So what did you do?
Well, one thing that I did was, you know, just based on what I learned from season one and season two, I knew they were going to throw things at you that were just completely, you know, non-firearm related. You know, I mean, they had atlatls and bows and arrows and you name it. So I've always had, you know, a couple of bows and things like that. But I ordered some throwing knives, and I ordered a couple of tomahawks. And I would go out in my backyard, and I live in a residential neighborhood, you know, so I couldn't like go out and just like start popping guns off in my backyard. But like my bow and the throwing knives and stuff like that was something I could go out there and play around with. So, you know, my next door neighbor, God bless him, he'd come out to mow his yard, and I'd be out there chucking knives and tomahawks. And he's like, Gary, is it okay for me to mow? I'm like, yeah, Mike, go ahead, you know. So you'll be fine. Just don't come too close to the fence. And but yeah, you know, so I did a lot of that, you know, like a lot of the you know, things like throwing, you know, even rocks, I mean, for God's sakes, which actually ended up being a challenge in our season three. At one point we threw rocks at window panes to get a tic-tac-toe. So I said the budget must have been running kind of low that day. They're breaking the rocks. You know, but yeah, like throwing knives, right. Tomahawks, stuff like that. And then the other thing I did was, if you notice on a lot of those challenges, is there's a huge physical element, and you can be as you know, as accurate as you want to be. And I always use Phil Morden as an example. You guys said you knew Phil. You know, I could be as good a shot as I want to be. I could be the most accurate person in the world. But if I've got to run up a hill against Phil, he could run up that hill and miss 20 times and still be faster than me. You know what I mean? So there was a huge physical element that I tried to prepare myself for too, just to, you know, try to keep up with some of those younger guys.
Sure.
Yeah. Right. Well, that's cool. That's good stuff.
Riley, I was just going to say that. I mean, that it's funny because we're talking about, you know, getting ready for Top Shot, and, you know, that's a very unique kind of competition, but that happens to be one thing that's extraordinarily applicable, just generally speaking. Like, shooters need to be in better shape.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. 100%.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, I push fitness in all my training. It's not something that, you know, that a lot of people have a tendency to cherry pick, you know, the things that they think are important. And, you know, if it means getting up off the couch and going on a 5 or 6 mile run, or, you know, going out to the beach and doing a heavy ruck run or something like that, it's not something that people just want to do in general. Now, if I give you a case of ammo and say, hey, let's go to the range and plink some rounds, you'd be like, yeah, sure, no problem. But if I say we're going to, you know, run 6 miles and do 1,000 push-ups and, you know, 200 pull-ups before we go out there, then you're less likely to be engaged with that type of training. So it is definitely something that people let fall off.
Yeah, yeah.
So speaking of, you know, so we talked about preparation for Top Shot. Gary, what do you do in general to prepare yourself? I mean, we know you're an agent with the DHS.
Yeah.
We know you're an instructor. I mean, you carry a gun as part of your job.
Yes.
And, you know, obviously we hope that you don't ever have to use it, but if you do, I mean, you need to be ready. What do you do to make sure that you are prepared?
I mean, there's a lot of different parts and pieces to that. You know, the training, obviously, you know, the drills and the dry fire and the preparation and stuff that I do physically, you know, to kind of get myself, I don't know what the word I'm fishing around for here is, but, you know, I need everything to be reflexive. Like if something happens, it's going to happen fast and it's going to happen when I'm least expecting it. I need everything to happen without me having to think about it. So I train enough to where my movements are reflexive. You know, an old instructor of mine used to say a lot that your body will not go where your mind hasn't been. So there's a lot of visualization, a lot of mental rehearsal and stuff that goes on. And then the other part of it is just knowing your equipment, you know, knowing, you know, what you need, what you don't need. Depending on the area you're going, how you need to dress, depending on how you're dressed, you know, how do you need to adjust the way you carry, because that does have a, you know, kind of an impact on it sometimes. But yeah, just, you know, just those things, the mental preparation, the physical preparation, obviously, trying to keep yourself fit, you know, trying to keep it so that you're, you know, you at least can control your heart rate enough to where you're not going to go complete, you know, blind whenever something happens and, you know, crap's kind of hitting the fan around you. You don't want to be that guy that's, you just can't control yourself physically.
What are some of the things that you really impart in your, as an instructor, like when you're training law enforcement officers, what are some of the things that you feel like you have to reiterate or really emphasize hard in that, you know, in that arena as an instructor?
Well, I think one of the most important things is just constantly reiterating the importance of sound fundamentals. You know, you can be as fast as you want to be, and everybody does when they come in. They want to get straight to the cool guy stuff, to what they call the advanced stuff. You know, show me some of the advanced. I've been shooting my whole life, so show me the advanced stuff. And, you know, I tell every one of them, it's, you know, the whole advanced shooter thing is kind of a non-starter for me. You know, nobody's really more advanced than the other. They've just got a deeper mastery of those fundamentals. So the one thing that I always harp on is, you know, you have to be fundamentally sound, because if you don't have that to fall back on, then when something goes wrong, you're not going to know how to react or how to adapt to the situation. So, you know, harping on the fundamentals, I'll do it every day till I die.
Great. Yeah. I mean, talk about like a trend we've been hearing lately, Riley, huh?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, Kyle Lamb mentioned that in episode 77 of the podcast.
Okay.
Mike Hughes.
Yeah. Mike Hughes, yeah, he definitely touched on that as well. So speaking of fundamentals, Gary, I mean, you talk about the importance of mastering those fundamentals. Is there anything in particular that you see maybe we fall short on You know, just in like, is there something that you emphasize more than another, or is it just kind of like everything all together you emphasize? I mean, I'm just curious on your strategy there.
Well, I think everybody has a different kind of a different take on what the actual building blocks are. Like, if you take one of these blocks away, the whole foundation is going to crumble. And, you know, some people are, you know, talking about, you know, like, okay, the fundamentals, say site alignment, you know, site alignment, site picture, trigger control, follow through, breathing, all these different things, you know, what stance, grip, all that different stuff. So what of those, if I took one of them away, would everything fall apart on? So, you know, I tell everybody, regardless of what kind of program you want to build as an instructor or what you want to learn as a student, I think if you could boil that down to just two things, if you could just take two things and then expand out from there, those two things would be your site management and your trigger control. So the bottom line is, it doesn't matter. There's an old saying, you know, like when you come out of the holster, the grip you get is the grip you got. You know, it may not be perfect, but in a gunfight, you're not going to have time to get a do-over. You're not going to have time to adjust that grip. The grip you get is the grip you got. So now you got to make do with it. So, you know, I may not have the perfect two-handed, you know, point shoulder shooting kind of grip because I could be injured. I could be shooting one hand. I could be shooting strong hand or support hand. But if I can manage my sights and I can work my trigger in a fashion that keeps those sights in alignment through the entire trigger press, then I can be successful. So sight management and trigger control are always the two things that I harp on. Everything else, and this is just my opinion, this is just, you know, Gary Questenberry's opinion, but, you know, everything else is built to you know, kind of hold that whole piece up, the sight alignment and the trigger control. So everything else is just there to make that easier or to make it more efficient. Mm-hmm. You know, that's kind of how I train.
Yeah, it makes sense.
What
are some of the things that, you know, in your training of law enforcement officers, let me back up here. I'm trying to think how to word this, Gary. Like, obviously, every law enforcement officer is also a citizen.
Right.
But not every citizen is a law enforcement officer.
Right.
So what are some of the things that to you are distinctly different between, you know, being on duty and being off duty, or things that you know, when you're talking to an everyday citizen like myself who has no law enforcement experience, you know, what are some of the things you're careful to say or not say that you know are different?
Are you talking about like when it comes to training, like if I'm training law enforcement?
Well, generally, I think whether we're talking about training or we're talking about, you know, day-to-day carry or strategy or tactics, you know, just what are things that don't translate well from one to the other that are very different?
Nothing really pops to mind. I mean, mm-hmm. The one thing that, you know, as a civilian, you know, as just a citizen, you know, if I'm talking to them, I'm very, very, you know, keen on having them understand what the laws are that regulate their actions, because every state's different. You know, not, you know, in Ohio, we have the Castle Doctrine, and you don't have that in every state. So, you know, now I live in New Jersey again. So, and New Jersey is completely different, you know, than Ohio was. And, you know, so I always try to make sure that people understand what their, you know, rights are as a citizen, and then make sure that they stay on top of how those change. Where as a law enforcement officer, you know, your jurisdiction and your, you know, kind of, for lack of a better term, the rules of engagement are laid out to you from day one, and they very seldom change, you know. So I have a little more leeway in where and how I can act, as opposed to the private citizen who, you know, may not be able just to. Perfect example is, you know, I'm an armed federal agent. I carry credentials and I'm armed, you know, so I don't have a problem walking into an establishment that says it's a gun-free zone. You know, I'm okay with just walking in there. And if they have, you know, security or whatever, no, you know, most of the time you can just show, you know, your creds and say, hey, I'm in law enforcement, and they have a system to get you in there or a place for you to store your weapon, or, you know what I mean? They take better care of you. Where mm-hmm. if you try that as a regular citizen, you're going to get a much different reaction out of the people who are, you know, they're kind of filtering that out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's a great example.
Yeah.
Yeah. The laws.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but that's better.
So, I want to pick your brain a little bit more in detail, Gary, about your specific training, because you mentioned something earlier that, you know, stood out to me, because I'm a big proponent of this myself, and that was dry fire or dry mm-hmm. practice. So that's clearly an important thing for you. Would you describe for us how you go about doing dry practice training?
Well, you know, a lot of times in people's dry practice, they'll throw on their rig and they won't necessarily throw on everything else that, you know, needs to be on with it. Like if I'm getting ready to go, you know, shopping with the family and it's wintertime and I've got on a coat, then when I start my dry practice, I want to make sure that I know I'm going to have that coat on while I'm out. So I want to practice with that coat, you know, and if I've got two or three layers on before I get to my gun, then how am I going to accomplish that? You know, what am I going to have to, how's this going to change my, you know, just your standard kind of draw stroke? If I'm just wearing a t-shirt and a pair of jeans, it's one thing, but if I got on a flannel and, you know, another heavy jacket over top of it or something like that, that changes things. So I make sure before I leave, if I'm going to do some dry practice, that I do it in a manner that's going to be, you know, reflective of how I'm going to be stepping out into the world with that gun. You know, I'm a big fan of appendix carry. That's just me. That's how I carry. I feel like that's the most, you know, easily accessible position to get to my gun. And in a fight, you know, if it came to me not being able to get it out and I end up on the ground, it's the most easily defensible position for me to have a gun. So, you know, I carry appendix carry. I always have a spare magazine on me. Depending on how I'm dressed, kind of dictates where that spare magazine may be. And it's not a perfect scenario because I think, you know, the more consistent I can be under stress, the more likely I am to be successful because I know where it's at. I've gone to it 1,000 times, where if I do that 1,000 times and I change that up and I go to a different pocket or I put it in a different spot because of the way I'm dressed, then under stress, I may hesitate or I may go to the wrong place before I realize, oh, you know, crap, I've got that, you know, magazine somewhere else. So I make sure that I have everything where I want it. And then I just, you know, repetitions. And, you know, they say that, you know, you got to have what, like 10,000 repetitions or something before it becomes a muscle memory. But, you know, I kind of know what the steps are in, you know, an emergency reload or speed reload or tactical reload or whatever. And I know based on how I'm dressed and where my equipment is, what I have to do to get that accomplished. So before I leave the house, you know, I come down to the basement, my little dry fire spot. I'm dressed the way I'm going to be dressed before I step out. And I just go over the drills. You know, what could possibly happen? Well, one, if there's something happen, I need to draw my gun. I've got to get to my gun. So you go through that. You know, if I go to slide lock, I need to do an emergency reload. I do that. And, you know, just kind of run through some scenarios. And there's a lot of mental preparation there too. Like I said, you know, your body won't go where your mind hasn't been. So you got to do a little bit of visualization along with that dry fire practice to make it more effective.
Yeah, you said something that I thought was really important. I mean, you talk about, you know, dry fire and obviously dry firing for a specific situation, but it was almost, I mean, the way you said that, Gary, it was almost like, you know, suggesting that almost every time before you leave the house, you do a little dry fire. It's like, okay, I'm going to go into the world now. I need to, you know, reset this in my brain now. I need to make sure I got some really recent, you know, trigger presses, and I've done a little bit of mental rehearsal right now. You know, I did that once, you know, I did that right. A long time ago, but it's fresh, right? Did I get that right?
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's not always the perfect scenario. Sometimes you got to rush out and, you know, everybody's in a hurry and you don't have time to actually, you know, throw your coat on, go down in the basement and go through everything the way, you know, you want to. But it's always beneficial if you can before you step out, you know, to get a couple repetitions with the draw stroke, you know, picking up a sight picture, you know, getting some dry fire trigger presses, going through some reloads, things like that. So it's, you know, in my opinion, it's always beneficial. I do it every chance I get. And when I'm going to work, it's without fail, I'm going to do it because, you know, that's, you know, to me, that's when I'm out there and the most likely to, you know, to get involved with something. So I want to make sure that my level of preparation is much higher than the guy that I'm going to be going up against.
Sure. Sure.
Yeah. Wise words. So, you know, going along with dry fire practice and your repetitions that you do on a day-to-day basis, which I just think is so important, and it sounds very similar to where I'm currently at with my own personal daily preparation is, you know, you're right, quite literally you get up, how am I dressed today? How am I going to be dressed? Where am I going to go? Well, you know, here's some repetitions going through this, working through that so that I know that's fresh in my mind, that I'm keeping those skills sharp. You did also mention too a little bit about being prepared mentally. What would you say to, I mean, we have a lot of new, you know, new CCWers, new gun owners even, mm-hmm. listening to this podcast. What would you like to impart to them, you know, as far as strategies or ways they might go about preparing themselves mentally for whatever they might encounter, you know, having to use deadly force, whatever, you know, what would you like to say to those folks?
Well, you know, I don't think that everybody is fully prepared for the level of violence that they would encounter in something like this. And, you know, I go back to, you know, I mentioned earlier about the old Colt single action army and having those cap guns when you were a kid. And you remember whenever you play, you know, cops and robbers or whatever you used to play as a kid with those little cap guns, you know, it was like, bang, bang, you're dead. I got you. You have to lay down. And you know, you grab your chest and you spin around a couple times and you'd fall down dead like a good bad guy. Right. And I think that that's one of the things that people carry along with them through their entire life. Like if someone shoots and I'm hit, then I got to be the good, you know, the good bad guy, or in some cases, you know, God forbid, the good guy, and I'm going down. And that's not the reality of it. That's not how it should go down. So I think the mental preparation is you've got to tell yourself that, you know, no matter what happens when I step out this door, one, you're taking a gun out into the world and you're prepared to use it if need be. But are you prepared to live through what's coming behind that? There has to be a level of, you know, I'm not going to die in this. Even if I'm hit, I'm still going to fight. You know, and I'm not, you know, we've got that ingrained in us as children, and what we see on TV, you see it in movies all the time, you know, television and stuff that kids watch, video games, whatever. Somebody's hit, they're down. You know, there's maybe a few dramatic words from their partner or whatever before they, you know, fade off or whatever. And it's, you know, you still got to fight. I don't care what the situation is or the circumstance. If you have an ounce of blood left in your body and you can fight with it, you have to do that. And I think that's important for people to wrap their head around before they actually step out there and think that, you know, they're going to make it through whatever kind of violent encounter they could come across.
Right. So never give up, never surrender, no. Sort of thing.
Never give up. Nah, absolutely. Yeah. And you know, it's not always going to be the perfect draw stroke. It's not always going to be the perfect sight picture. You know, there's going to be a level of chaos and things around you that could, that you can never simulate, you know, in your garage or even on the range in most cases. So, you know, I think a lot of that is where the visualization and the mental preparation comes in. But just kind of rewiring yourself away from that, you know, bang, you're dead kind of mentality that you develop as a child, and getting into the real world, the adult world of, you know, I'm going to fight till the last drop, you know, seeps out of me. That's just pretty much the way it has to be.
Yeah.
You know, thinking about that, or maybe more, you know, generally speaking, Gary, what do you think are some of the major mistakes that shooters make? Whether, you know, we're talking about, you know, the people you train, the law enforcement officers, or maybe more broadly, you know, just your everyday carry person. What are some of the mistakes that you see all the time, you know, those little pet peeves of yours?
Well, you know, there's a lot of things that get under my skin, and I don't know how long your podcast is, but one of the things I think people need to put a little more thought into, and this pertains mostly to, like, you know, the civilian side of things and like the new CCW people, the new CCW people specifically. You know, I used to work for a company where we did a little bit of training on the side from my day job. And we actually thought maybe it'd be a good idea at some point that we would actually teach the CCW class in Ohio. So we got the accreditation and stuff that we needed. You know, we had the certificates and we had all the training hours and our program and everything was approved. And the first time we ran one of those, you know, we put the advertisement out to people. People show up to our class. It was a very popular class. But the one thing that I saw the most was people just showing up with a gun that was obviously not for them. You know, you gotta know, one, what you're willing to carry, because a lot of people see, you know, a big fancy gun that one of their friends had, you know, and they want one just like that. So they go pick it up, you know, say like a big full size SIG 229 or whatever. All right. And, then they get out there on the range and they're wearing it just kind of out in the open. Well, one, I'm teaching a CCW class, so I want it to be concealed. You know, I want you to actually kind of think through how this is going to go in the real world. You're not just going to walk around with that thing hanging out. And then they start putting on the things that they would put on, whether it be a jeans or t-shirt or whatever. And they realize that because of the way they dress or their body type, that they're not prepared to conceal, you know, such a gun. Or, you know, they're just this big giant person with great big hands, like, you know, Hams or whatever. And, you know, they come out with a little Glock 42, and it's just not the, you know, I mean, any gun could be good for any person, I suppose, but, you know, put a little thought into to how you dress, what your goals are, you know, in terms of concealment, how you plan on carrying, how are you going to get to it, and then, you know, are you going to be efficient with it when you're training? You know, it could be too big for your hand so that it's almost impossible for you to get a smooth trigger press and manage your sights at the same time. So just doing a little bit of research, talking to people who are out there, you know, carrying concealed for a while, or, you know, they're gun enthusiasts and kind of understand that fit and function of, you know, what you need, and putting some thought into that first purchase before you show up, you know, with a Python revolver for, you know, a CCW class. I've seen it happen, but it's
right.
Yeah. You just got to put some thought on that.
That's a good point. Yeah, good tip. Now, so along those same lines, no, oh, go ahead, Riley.
You go ahead, Jacob. I'll let you take that, because I can tell you got somewhere you want to go.
Yeah, no, I was going to say, along those same lines, you mentioned, you know, people, you know, picking the wrong gun to begin with, not really thinking through some of those elements. I was going to ask you to try and elaborate a little bit more. Like, have you ever taken someone to the gun shop to kind of help them through that purchasing process? Above what you already said, what other tips would you give someone in trying to pick the right gun?
Well, one, just make sure it fits your hand, you know, and a lot of people, like, you know, when we lived in Ohio, there was a family friend of ours. It was one of my wife's doctors, actually. You know, I took him out to help him because he started wanting to go to the range and he wanted to start carrying concealed and he didn't know where to start. So we go to the range, and the first thing we did was, they actually, like a lot of gun ranges, they had a counter where you could rent, you know, different guns and shoot. So we'd get, you know, different boxes of ammunition. We rent different guns and we took him out and shot. And, you know, the first thing I tried to have him wrap his head around was, you know, you have to be able to control the gun. It has to fit you, and it has to fit how you plan on carrying when you're carrying concealed. So once we got that narrowed down, then it became an issue of, you know, caliber. Like, what can you control? You know, if you're shooting a 45, but you can't control the recoil on it, then your follow-up shots aren't going to be as fast, or they're not going to be as accurate. It could possibly scare the hell out of you, and you don't even want to pull the trigger again a second time. So, you know, we made sure we understood what he was wanting to carry, because what you want and what you need, you know, are two completely different things. And, you know, I think you should learn that as a child. But, you know, once we got it all narrowed down to what his specific goal was in terms of, you know, how he wanted to carry, under what circumstances and when, what he could control and what fit him personally, then it's fairly easy to narrow down what works best. And of course, you know, with most guns, there's going to be a range of firearms within that, you know, those specific categories. So once you find the size and the caliber and everything that has what you're looking for in it, as far as, you know, say magazine capacity and things like that, there's going to be a range of guns to pick from. So then it's just a matter of finding out, you know, what you're most comfortable with. You know, if you're looking for something that's got a manual safety on it, you know, that's going to be another step in your training that you're going to have to accommodate. But, you know, if you just got something like a Glock, you know, it's kind of a pull the trigger and it goes bang type thing. That's a lot more simplistic. And in the beginning, I think that simple is always better. So the more simple you can make something, you know, the more likely it's going to be for you to, as a beginning shooter, somebody that's just getting new, you know, new to firearms, new to the CCW thing, the more simplistic it is and the more confident they are with it, the more likely they're going to be to actually pick it up when they walk out of the house and put it on.
That makes sense.
So we're getting kind of close here to where we're going to start wrapping it up, but there's a couple things I wanted to make sure we covered, because I'm really curious. I got it here. I know that you're a triple nickel coin holder.
Yeah, absolutely. Coin number 5, as a matter of fact.
That's a pretty big deal. But I know we have listeners that probably don't understand how big a deal that is. So would you explain for us what the triple nickel is and how one goes about achieving that, how that all comes about?
Well, yeah, I'll give you a little bit of history on it. When I first started working as an instructor for the Department of Homeland Security, our training facility was in Atlantic City. And when I first got there, we didn't have any students coming through. So we had a couple of months of downtime. And we had an instructor who I think, you know, one of the guys you had on the show, Kyle Lamb, maybe good friends with this guy. His name's Kelly Vinden. And he works for a company now called Criterion Tactical. And just a phenomenal instructor. I learned so much from this guy. And Kelly, you know, used to come, because I was brand new there. Nobody really knew who I was or how I could shoot or, you know, what my whole mindset was towards training or whatever. So he would always come over to my cubicle and say, "Hey, man, you want to go out to the range and shoot?" So we go out and shoot, and he would set up some drills, and we'd just shoot a few drills. And, you know, in hindsight, I realized what he was doing was he's kind of gauging my accuracy and my, you know, just kind of my skill level with a firearm in general. And once he realized that, you know, I may be capable of shooting this triple nickel drill, he would introduce me to it. So he goes, "Hey, I want to show you something. I want to see if you can do it." He said, "We've had a lot of instructors try it, but only, you know, two or three people have ever been able to do it successfully." And he said, "It's called the triple nickel." So he set it up for me. And what it is you've got five targets in front of you. You're 5 yards away, and you've got 5 seconds. That's the triple nickel. And when the pack timer goes off, you have to draw your weapon from concealment. It's got to be covered. And you've got to shoot 2 rounds in each target. So you're shooting 2, 2, 2, 2. And then you have to do a reload. And you can set it up however you want to, an emergency reload, you know, a slide lock emergency reload or a speed reload. You have to do a reload and then shoot 2 additional rounds into the last target before the, you know, before it phases away or before the pack timer goes off again. And that's all in 5 seconds. So, I mean, you think about that, and you have to have them all inside the bottle. And we were using the old FBI QIT targets. So it's all got to be inside the bottle. And if anything's touching the line, it doesn't count. The benefit doesn't go to the shooter. So he took me out and introduced me to this drill. And when I first shot it the first couple times, I'm like, man, this is almost impossible. You know, I don't see how anybody could do this. And Kelly's up there. He's just a good old boy from Texas. You know, and he's just so casual about it. And he's making this look easy. And I worked and worked and worked and worked all day, you know, trying to get this thing. And you get close, and there was one little thing that shut you down. You fumbled the reload, or your draw stroke wasn't very smooth, or you messed up on a transition and you threw a round out. And there's just so much cussing going on throughout the day. You know, you just get so frustrated with yourself. But after about an hour or 2 hours, and God knows how many iterations of this, I finally got it one time. And, you know, Kelly was very supportive. He's like, "Oh, man, look at you go. You know, you did really, really good." So I was so excited about it. I'm telling everybody, right? "Hey, man, I got the triple nickel today. And this is before we had coins or anything, right? And so Kelly says, "Oh, it's a fantastic job." So then the next day we go out, we're going to do it again. And now I'm more used to it. I understand what I have to do to accomplish this. So that day I got it three times. Three times I completed this, right? And we're walking back and I'm, you know, my head's all big and, you know, and I got a really big lesson in humility this day too from Kelly, and I appreciate him for it. But we're walking back to the training center, and I can't wait to get back and brag to everybody about how I got this three times. And I'm like, "Man, I did it, you know, three times. And Kelly's like, "Yeah, that's fantastic." Kelly said, "But how many times do you think you shot it?" I go, "I don't know, 30. He goes, "So you failed 27 times. I was like, "Wow." You know, so then when I went back, you know, I didn't say anything about it. I just realized that I've got a whole lot of work to do if I want to be at the level this guy's at. So, you know, the triple nickel, the way it was born and the way Kelly developed it was to gauge an instructor's ability to kind of practice what he preaches. Like, you know, are you fundamentally, because that's all it is, you know, it's a measure of how well you can master the fundamentals and apply those fundamentals under incredibly compressed, you know, time restraints. So, you know, it finally became a big thing where, you know, guys are going out there, and it got instructors out, and it got us talking, and it got us working together, and it got us shooting and having fun, which built camaraderie. And then once the students started coming in, you know, they saw that. They saw that we had a good crew and that we worked well together, and we were incredibly proud of this thing that we were accomplishing with the triple nickel. So then eventually it turned into, well, let's make up some coins. And then we came up with a rule set, and you know, it just kind of morphed and grew into this giant thing where now I think there's like 187 coin holders around the world. And it's open to anybody who is, you know, law enforcement or military, or a law enforcement military trainer that wants to try it. And if you'd like, I can send you guys like the rules and stuff for it if you want to give it a shot. It's pretty, it's a really good drill. We're super proud of it, and it's not an easy task, and once you do it, you know, you realize, all right, you realize where your weak points are and what you got to work on. So,
Absolutely,
I'd love to see it.
Yes, I've not officially attempted it, but I've dabbled.
Yeah, hey,
I've done a few loose attempts, and I definitely need to work on some stuff. But yeah, absolutely. Send us along the official rules. That'd be great to have.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Just for reference.
Yeah, and we actually our first international coin holder. He's a guy from Australia. He works out there. And he just came through the training academy out here in Atlantic City and got the triple nickel coin. So, you know, just we're all over the place now, man. It's crazy.
Oh, that's great. Cool. Now, so the final question is going to be, Gary, I was going to ask you if you have any favorite drills you like to incorporate into your training. And realizing that we've just now talked about the triple nickel drill, is that the drill, or is there anything else that you think is just really an awesome drill or really valuable to learn and train with as far as your training or any other gun owner's training for that matter?
Well, I mean, you know, the triple nickel is like a culmination of a lot of different drills, you know, and it's more of a kind of a practical exercise in a sense that it measures all these different things. As an instructor, whether I'm working with experienced shooters or whether I'm working with, you know, somebody who's brand new, I think one very invaluable drill, and I'm sure you guys know what I'm talking about here, is just a ball and dummy drill where, you know, you have somebody prep your magazines for you, you throw a couple of dummy rounds in there so that when you, you know, when you hit that dummy round, you can kind of see a muzzle dip and you know that you're anticipating that round breaking. And, you know, that's not going to make you very, very accurate or efficient whenever the time comes that you need to do that. But, you know, it also has you work through a primary immediate action, you know, tapping and racking and clearing that dummy round. So, you know, I think we train, no matter how much you train, I think most people train for like the perfect scenario, like everything's perfect. And I think you have to kind of interject some of that imperfection. So, you know, what could possibly go wrong? Like worst case scenario, I get a double feed and I'm in the middle of a mall with my family and now here my gun is jammed up. You know, I've seen so many people that don't know how to clear that, you know, and you can tell me you've been carrying concealed for, you know, the last 10 years, that's fine. But if you don't know how to clear that, you might as well be carrying a brick in your pocket. So, right. You know, I think primary, secondary, immediate actions, just the old school ball and dummy drills, things like that. The things that don't necessarily come to mind when you think about, you know, what drill should I be doing today are the things that a lot of people kind of falter on and they don't work on as much as they should.
That's good advice.
Yeah. So excellent. So folks, if you want to, like I said, tune in to and see Gary Quesenberry in our live broadcast, which will be, by the time you're listening to this podcast, it'll be this Thursday evening at 7 p.m. Mountain Time. So that's actually going to be on January 19th? I should have double checked before.
Yeah, 19th.
It's January 19th. Yep, because we're releasing this podcast on the 16th. So on the 19th of January, 7 p.m. Mountain Time, we're going to be going over a bunch of things like we've covered today in this podcast episode with Gary, and then some. Plus, give you listeners the opportunity to ask him questions directly. So don't miss out on that. Definitely, you know, make sure that you're signed up with Guardian Nation, that you can go in and tune into our live broadcast for the month of January, which we're going to be doing, Jacob and I, while we are attending SHOT Show, actually. So that'll be pretty exciting.
Yeah, I'm going to miss that this year.
We're sorry to hear that.
Yeah, I was looking forward to coming out. But, you know, with the, you know, I got a business and stuff now. And, you know, once I get a booth and everything out there, you can expect to see me back.
There you go.
Absolutely. Yeah. So speaking of business, Gary, you are the founder and owner of Q-Series LLC. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, I guess I'm the president is what's on my business card, whatever, you know, weight that holds.
Okay.
But yeah, we make some holsters and, later on in January, we're going to be releasing our first run of magazine carriers. And it's, you know, it's kind of funny how it all started, man. It was, you know, I built a holster for myself just in my garage one weekend out of boredom. And, someone on the range saw it and showed it to somebody else who was like, man, you could totally build this. And now that person's my partner in the business. And, you know, if you go to Galls, you know, you guys are familiar with Galls, the police supply.
Yeah.
So you go to Galls and you look at holsters and the Q-Series holster pops up. That's the number one best-selling holster on Galls right now. So it's pretty popular.
I found mine at Neves there in Denver.
Yeah, absolutely. And, matter of fact, man, the Neves, those guys are the ones that got me started in the business because – it all happened at SHOT Show, and I made like five or six of these things to show to a few people. And the Neves brothers had me come out to their Glock days to sign autographs when the Top Shot thing was going on. And we're out at dinner one night, and I show them these holsters, and I'm like, hey, man, check out these holsters I made. You guys should carry them in your store. And they looked at it, and they're like, oh, that's fantastic. And at the time, now, I'm melting plastic in a toaster oven that we got from Walmart making these holsters. And he goes, man, that's fantastic. So we are going to place an order. So he's like, he's conferring with his brothers, and he's like, okay, we want 200 of them. And I was like, I'm going to have to get a bigger toaster. You know, and man, we worked some long nights getting that order out. But our first order of holsters that ever went out, you know, the old school ones before we went to the injection molding, went out to Neves in Denver. So, yeah, those guys got us started, yeah. Man. They're great people.
Oh, that's cool. That makes me really happy to hear, actually. It's one of my favorite stores in the world. So that's great.
Yeah.
And I've noticed, too, that they're frequently pretty low on stock, so they must be selling them pretty well, I assume.
Yeah, it's you know, we get a lot of reorders on them, and now we're kind of global. I mean, the Israelis are carrying them, you know, some of their SF guys and you know, their aviation specialists and stuff are carrying them. They're in Australia, Austria, even Turkey, for God's sake. So I mean, we're all over the place now. Yeah, it's, and the holster, you know, the one that got us started was, I call it the stealth holster, and it's just a little minimalist appendix carry inside the waistband holster that's I like to say it's everything you need and nothing you don't. But I mean, you know as well as I do, everybody that carries concealed or works in law enforcement, everybody has that box of holsters in their closet. Mm-hmm. That yep. You know. Oh, yeah. And the wife's like, hey, when are you gonna get rid of those holsters? And you're like, never. I never know when I might need one. So but, you know, I kind of went through that and found elements of certain holsters that I liked. There's some things I didn't like, you know, to me, you know, just bulk and stuff like that, given how I carry and for extended periods of time in very cramped conditions, you know, I just don't want all that bulk and stuff pressing around me. So I whittled it down to the bare bones. And that's kind of what the Q-Series Stealth holster is. It's just a little minimalist holster, and it works really well.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm a fan. Yeah. Been carrying in that quite a bit lately, actually.
Oh, and I'm glad to hear it.
And then you also got the Covert holster, which is a OWB holster, right?
Yeah. You know, a lot of people are not necessarily comfortable with inside the waistband. There's a lot of people out there that are uncomfortable with appendix carry, which, you know, I don't understand why. But, you know, so we developed something a little more traditional, just an outside the waistband everyday holster. But right now we only have that when it fits Glocks, like Glock 17s, 19s, 23s, things like that.
Mm-hmm. And then you mentioned late in January, as you said, that you've got the mag carriers coming. So
it's kind of a universal deal. We've got a double stack magazine carrier, which will fit double stack magazines for just about every manufacturer. We've got single stack magazine carriers. And then we're going to be developing a third one, which will fit the, you know, for 45s, because 45s are obviously so much bigger. But
right. Oh, good stuff. Good work. And I'm sure it's keeping you busy.
That's exciting.
With everything that you do in a day-to-day basis with your real job.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then all this on the side, I presume, right?
Yeah, it keeps you pretty busy, man. I mean, it's, you know, your days off aren't really days off, but it's, you know, it's rewarding. It's rewarding, you know, both of my jobs. So, you know, I really enjoy getting out there doing what I do, and on the side, you know, having something that, you know, I'm passionate about, because I think that, you know, carrying concealed and, you know, for guys that do it for a living and they depend on, you know, they depend on their equipment just as much as they would depend on their partner, just as much as they depend on the firearm they carry. And knowing that a lot of people turn to us for that, you know, that's very meaningful for me, and I really appreciate it.
Cool.
Great. Well, we appreciate you. So.
Yeah, thanks,
before I forget, today's episode, folks, is brought to you by, and I kind of mentioned already, by Guardian Nation. And Guardian Nation is the community for devoted gun people focused on guarding themselves, their families, homes, and communities. We hope that you'll check it out and consider joining, whether it be for the monthly training and drill videos, discounts on products in our store, the monthly Guardian Nation live broadcasts with top industry professionals like Gary here, coming up this Thursday evening at 7 p.m. Mountain, or the quarterly box of handpicked Guardian gear. There's something for everyone in becoming a member of Guardian Nation. So please go check it out now at guardiannation.com. And Gary's already mentioned it, but go check out Gary's awesome products at qseriesllc.com. Did I get that website right?
Yeah, you sure did. Appreciate it.
Great. And so because we always do this in our episodes of the podcast, we want to have you give us your pick of the week, Gary.
Yeah, actually, you know, I do a lot of overseas travel, and you know as well as I do, you're not always, you know, packing a gun or, you know, weapons of any sort. But a friend of mine, we were sitting at dinner one night, and we were talking about that very fact. And he was like, well, you got to check this out. This is my coin purse. And he pulls out what is basically, and these may be around for a long time, but I mean, it's brand new to me. This is the first time I'd ever seen it. And it was a coin sap. So it's like an old leather and lead sap, real heavy duty leather, a big heavy duty zipper. You unzip it, and he had it full of British pounds. And I don't know if you're familiar with British pounds, but it's a pretty heavy coin. And man, you could just knock the devil out of somebody with one of those things. But he said he's never had a problem with it in terms of, you know, getting through security. It's leather. It's, you know, it's just an empty leather coin purse. You throw your change in it, and all of a sudden you've got a little bit of an impact weapon there that could be, you know, fairly useful in a place where you're not necessarily allowed to be armed. And it doesn't have to be overseas. I mean, you could take that thing anywhere, and it's perfectly legal.
Nice. Do you have, is there some way of attaching a little string or cord to it?
So yeah.
Flail that thing around? Is that the idea here?
Well, actually, you know, I got to looking into them, because obviously once I saw it, I'm like, man, I got to have one of these. And there's a place, it's called Foster Impact Devices. And they sell the more traditional like saps and things like that, but they have the coin saps. And there's actually different makes and models. They got different kind of handles. Some of them come with like a key ring on the end of it that you could attach like a paracord attachment, or I think they actually make a leather loop, you know, like a wrist loop that would attach to that key ring. And it's just a solid piece of kit. And I don't know why I don't have one of these already, but it's definitely on my wish list.
Yeah, that's cool.
Okay.
Yeah,
that's my pick of the week right there. I highly recommend picking one of those up.
Yeah, I've looked it up. I looked up Foster Impact Devices, and I'm going to include a link in the show notes for our listeners. That's now that I'm looking at an image describing it, it makes a world of sense.
Right? Yeah, yeah. You click on the coin sap, and you go down there, and you can see it comes in different colors, but it's a, you know, it looks like a quality piece of leather. It's got a good sturdy zipper, and, you know, You can't hit somebody with your pocket, so it only makes sense to have your change in one of these, right?
Nice. Cool. Thanks for the tip and for putting us onto that. FosterImpactDevices.com is a website for those listening, and I've put that in the show notes. Pick of the week for you, Jacob.
Last pass. Has this ever been my pick before? I'm hoping I'm not duplicating a pick. But
we've had so many, I don't know that I could remember.
Yeah, I don't think I could either. But for those who aren't familiar with LastPass, it's a program. It's what I would call a freemium product. So you can have it's a free service, but obviously you can pay for some better, you know, advanced features or whatever. But LastPass is a password memory thing. So you set up a LastPass account. You obviously want to have a really good, strong password for your LastPass account, but then it will save, it'll import all of your passwords for all your websites and stuff from your browser. And then when you go to a website where there's a login field, if LastPass is installed on your browser and you're logged into LastPass, it'll autofill your username and password for you. And this is going to sound crazy, but I honestly do not even know my password for like anything. Like, I don't know the password for my email address, my email account. I don't know the only password I know is my LastPass account password. And it's really crazy. And if you really wanted to sign up for like their top service, it's a whopping like $12 a year. And that basically gives you the mobile app. And the mobile app is awesome, because even like when I open, I don't know, the Facebook app on my phone, it'll populate the login info for me, even, you know, on a phone. So LastPass is so freaking cool. I just love it.
Hmm. Good pick, Jacob. And you were the gentleman that put me onto LastPass as well. And it's great. I love it. And it's way more secure than having Google or, you know, Mozilla. If you're using a Firefox browser, it's way more secure than having your browsers or other things, you know, store or memorize that password for you.
Well, it'll do audits. So you can have LastPass audit all your passwords. Yeah. It'll go through and be like, whoa, you know, this password's really crappy. This password. I remember when I first set up LastPass, it made me change like 95% of my passwords because they were all the same thing. And LastPass was like, no, you know, we're not going to let you have the same password everywhere. And at first those changes are hard. It's hard to kind of trust LastPass, but you know, I'm over, I don't know, a year and a half into that, and I'm so happy that I don't get hacked anymore. I don't have to worry about any of that anymore. It's just stellar. It's really good.
Mm. Oh, great. Good pick. Thanks, Jacob. And my pick this week is a knife. And it is actually something that our good friend over at Brave Response Shooting, Jacob, that makes a Brave Response holster that we sell so many of as well. We had a meeting, a couple months ago? And he brought this little knife with him to our meeting. And I got my hands on it, and I was just super impressed, especially for the price point. And that is the Columbia River Knife and Tool, or CRKT. It's the 5461K Ikoma Fossil. It's got a G10 grip on it. It's got a really good quality steel. I can't remember the exact grade of steel, but it's a great blade. And you're talking like you can get this thing on Amazon for $50 or less. Super, super, super nice knife. Really smooth, clean, easy to use action on it. You know, you pull it out, flick it, and, you know, it's ready to go. It's very, very, very nice. I believe the action on its ball bearings. And I mentioned that I've got the 5461K. I think it was Brandon. He actually brought the 5471K. The difference is, I think the larger one, the 5471K, is about a 4-inch blade. And the one I picked up is a 3.4-inch length blade. So go check it out if you're interested in, you know, looking into a knife. It does have a little bit thicker profile than I'd probably like as far as having in my pocket all the time. But it's just such a nice knife for $50 or less. So the Columbia River Knife and Tool 5461K or 5471K, which is its big brother. Either one, great knives. Go check it out. There's a link in the show notes to takes you right to Amazon. And so, Gary, anything new and exciting? Or it doesn't even have to be new and exciting, but what's coming up next for you, buddy?
Well, you know, there's a lot going on, you know, just between work and the whole Q series thing and getting these magazine carriers off the ground. That's really all I'm focused on right now. So, you know, we're going to spend the whole year just working on marketing and advertising and, you know, being on you guys' podcast, and you guys letting me kind of plug my business really helps me out a lot. I appreciate it.
Oh, great. Well, like, yeah, I said, it's our pleasure
to have you on.
Mm-hmm. And we hope to do more with you, frankly. So, besides the live broadcast coming up. Jacob, how about you?
Well, our company has a big announcement coming up. We recently had an acquisition. I think I hinted at it one other time here on the podcast, but here soon, I think we'll have a lot of the kind of nuts and bolts figured out on our end. And so I'm hoping next week on the podcast that we'll be making a big announcement.
Cool. Glad to hear it. And for me, my up next is SHOT Show, which I kind of alluded to already. And so by the time you're listening to this episode, we are actually on the ground in Las Vegas. I've got media credentials this year. Me and my cameraman, Corey, and then Jacob as well. We're going to be going around and doing a ton of video interviews, checking out all the different booths, new products, and really hoping to just bring a lot of new, cool, exciting stuff to those of you that listen to this podcast or follow us on our various media channels, YouTube channel and whatnot. So really, really excited for SHOT Show and expecting really great things this year. And we hope that Gary is able to get his booth very soon. Yeah, hopefully next year.
Yeah, I'm hoping so too. I'm tired of walking around here feeling like I'm selling stolen watches out of a trench coat, you know?
So true.
Yeah, hey man, you want to buy a holster kind of thing? So yeah. I'd like to make it a little more official. I think we're above all that now. So
nice. Oh, that's great stuff. Well, once again, just a reminder, folks, don't miss the live broadcast together with Jacob, myself, and Gary Quesenberry from Q Series LLC. And that'll be this Thursday evening, January 19th at 7 p.m. Mountain Time. So with that, we're going to wrap it up for today and for this week. Thanks again, Gary. It's been really a true pleasure, and you're such a gentleman. So thanks for joining us on the podcast this week.
Yeah, guys, the pleasure was all mine. I really appreciate you guys having me on.
Cool. Well, with that, we will see you all later. Take care, train hard, be safe.
A reminder that laws vary from place to place, and we encourage listeners to seek local legal advice to understand applicable laws. USA Firearm Training and the Concealed Carry Podcast strive to share insights and stories about firearm-related incidents and laws, but things could be different where you live, or laws may have changed by the time you listen to this. We cannot be held liable for your actions based on the information shared in the podcast.